From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood joins us in studio. He is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. A great way to end a vacation week.
Do you ever have anything but vacation weeks? Do you actually have a real job anymore?
Well, I think that's subject to debate by some people, but I think I have a real job, and this is part of it right here.
I see you on NBC4 all the time, so I know you're working. Also joining us in studio is Adam Eben. He's a Virginia state senator. He's a Democrat representing the 30th District, which includes parts of Arlington, Alexandria, and Fairfax County. Senator Eben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments for the senator, call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. I guess the big news this morning, Tom and Senator Eben, is that a federal appeals court has thrown out the corruption conviction of former Virginia First Lady Maureen McDonnell, and apparently her appeal was based on the Supreme Court's decision to throw out her husband's conviction, saying that the definition of the term official act was too broad in the prosecution's case there, and they're, I guess, negotiating over what happened next. Tom Sherwood, do you think we should say this was expected given what happened in the...
I'd say this is as surprising as the sun coming up in the east.
Yes, it is.
In the west. The Supreme Court reset the table on what corruption and ethics in government office is, public service is. I'd love to hear the senator's view on this. But it's now much harder for prosecutors to bring a corruption charge without an official act, something actually tangible being done on someone's behalf. And I'd like to remind people, even as people thought this was a slam dunk that McDonnell would lose in the Supreme Court, something like 42, 44 attorneys general from around the nation had written the court saying that this interpretation of the conspiracy bribery laws was way too broad. And so we're seeing it now play out.
What do you say, Senator Allen?
Well, I think that the former governor should have been found guilty of something. And the
bad judgment.
Well, bad judgment to start. But also in Virginia, we have a law that you have to disclose gifts that you receive. And he clearly hid those gifts. It was just a misdemeanor before. He was never charged with that. It's now a felony to do that. But this doesn't pass, more than doesn't pass the smell test. I would have liked to see him spend at least a day in jail.
What do you think is going to happen with the negotiations now? Do you think there'll be another trial here, or do you think the prosecution is just going to walk away?
I yield to the public official to my left.
Well, yield to the senator.
It's up to the U.S. attorney, but after what they've gone through, I don't think they're going to ask for another trial.
It's the U.S. attorney, Dana Boente. How do you say his last name? Boente?
I don't know.
B-O-E-N-T. I was trying to pronounce it with my southern accent. But they have a very short time, I think, to the end of August, where they have to decide whether to move forward with the governors. I mean, this is a 1-2 punch for the prosecution in this case. Certainly the McDonald's have suffered an irreparable, I think, public relations of personal problem with what they did and how they did it, whether they're legally convicted of doing very stupid things. That will always tar them no matter what happens between now and going forward.
Of course, it
destroyed their marriage.
Well, it's a disgrace. I don't know how their marriage was doing before, but I've had colleagues point out that if you do a favor for someone who has helped you or as a friend, that's the broad problem of it, I guess, the Supreme Court found. But I don't think we should be doing favors for people who give us those kinds of gifts and are seeking government help at the same time.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. We're going to pivot to the District of Columbia for a few minutes here, Senator Eben, where the brouhaha involving at-large Councilmember Vincent Orange taking a job as head of the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, which he starts on August 15th while he continues to sit on the council, continues to go on. But it seems to me, Tom, that one thing that emerges from this is that our council members apparently don't talk with one another a great deal. When Councilmember Orange was on this broadcast, we asked him what did the other council members have to say to him about it. He said no one was in contact with him. Of course, when he made the announcement, I guess they would argue that he didn't consult with them before he made the announcement. But you would think that these are individuals who should be able to pick up the phone and talk with one another.
Well, there's 13 independent islands down there. You know, I just tweeted some news that I learned this morning. I've tweeted out now that there are, in fact, ongoing conversations, private conversations, about when Vince Orange will resign his council seat, not whether, that he will, in fact, do it. And one of the pressures on this is that he's been the D.C. Council, the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, some of the members of the board there have said that if he doesn't quell this by resigning from the council, that his job with the chamber could be lost because they could not have a lobbyist, and that's what the job is. It's lobbying for the chamber. The chamber could not have someone who has been severely damaged by this ethics issue. So there is expectation that Vince Orange, I don't know when he'll announce it or when he'll say, but he will be resigning sooner rather than later.
But couldn't there be conversations like, hey, Vince, this is Mary. It's my understanding that you're thinking of doing this. Do you think that's a really good idea? Let's talk about it.
Well, you know, in a 13-member legislature, as opposed to a 40-member Senate or whatever is a 100-member House.
We're going to get to that in a second.
Your ability to stay in your lane and not publicly disparage or get involved in someone else's problem is a real issue. You have to have 7 votes. And if you're, I mean, David Catania, you learned this, and others have learned it on the council. If you're out there publicly denouncing this or that, then in the back, when you try to get something done, they say, well, why should I help you? You've savaged me. So it's a tough thing. That's why the chairman, you know, I think he said yesterday on Bruce DuPoit's show, you know, that would be better if Vincent Orange simply resigned. Now, the chairman knows legally, technically, there's no way to force Vince Orange to resign, but for the good of the council, which is only just now recovering from that horrific period, you know, of a few years ago when 3 council members left the council on their clouds and felony convictions. I just think this is a really terrible thing, and Vince Orange is smart enough. He can actually be very good for the chamber. He knows a lot about labor, and he has a lot of labor support. He supported small businesses. There are a lot of good things he can do, but not if there's this cloud of doom over his head.
Well, Adam Evan, you should know something about this because you sit in a really part-time legislature where just about everybody has a job doing something else. How often does that issue come up?
Not very often, but ethics is partly a self-policing issue. In Virginia, you're only supposed to abstain if you have a direct financial interest in a vote, and there's a lot more than just direct financial interest, peripheral interests and things that just don't look good. We're losing a lot of voter trust because of things like what the governor, former governor, did. Questions about people who have an obvious conflict of interest, like Councilmember Orange. People don't think well of politicians, and it tars the rest of us.
Virginia has, on a scale of 1 to 50, 50 state ethics laws, where does Virginia rank?
Well, we've been near the
one
bottom.
Being the worst.
We've been near the very bottom from people who've rated them. We've done minor tinkering with the law, and there was a proposal to make it worse than it was this session that we tamped down.
Well, on Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court said a Virginia school board could temporarily block a transgender student, Gavin Grimm, from using the boys' restroom while the case goes forward on appeal. It's been a long and complicated case. The Department of Justice had weighed in, as well as Virginia's Attorney General, after you asked him to issue an opinion earlier this year. What might this latest reversal mean?
Well, it means at least temporarily that there's no progress, no fairness, but I'm hoping that the court will eventually allow the lower court's ruling to stand, or at least take it up and rule the right thing, which is to allow people to have non-discrimination protections. I've gotten some letters from people who are concerned about what bathrooms people are using in schools. And I've tried to remind them that people who are transgender don't always present as the gender that they were born with. I know a person who's transgender who has a full beard, shaved head, big build, and, you know, under the proposals that some would want, they'd want him to use the ladies' room. And I don't know how they would police it, but there isn't a problem. Just let these kids do what they need to do.
I'm just saying, what does this young person do now while the court where do they stand? I mean, what do they do when they're at school and they're public? I mean, obviously, this is the way to fix this is to have multi-sex restrooms. It's where you have restrooms where anyone can go, small individual facilities. That solves a lot of problems.
Sure. But that, I mean, I would hope that the school would be humane, and while this is happening, there are private bathrooms, whether they're
like the faculty uses them
or for faculty, et cetera. And I hope that they'll allow Gavin to use one of those in the interim if there's one in his school.
Is there any indication that how quickly this will be taken up by the court?
It's up to the Supreme Court when they announce what they're going to take up. They have not said that they will take it up.
Right.
They've just put it on stay until they decide.
Our guest is Adam Eben. He's a Virginia State Senator, Democrat, representing the 30th District, which includes parts of Arlington, Alexandria, and Fairfax Counties. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. You can call us at 800-433-8850. If you have comments or questions, you can send an email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of this conversation, or shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. Senator Eben, you and Delegate Mark Sickles of Fairfax have filed bills to repeal Virginia's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Virginia voters passed that amendment to the state's constitution by 57%, of course. The Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in a 2015 ruling. So why repeal an amendment that cannot be enforced, and what's the process here?
Sure. Well, the process is complicated. We need to get it started this year. But in terms of why the Constitution and the Code of Virginia should accurately reflect the law of the land, people should be able to look in the code and know what the law is. But secondly, all citizens, including gay and lesbian citizens, deserve the dignity of not being discriminated against in our governing documents. When we amended the Constitution, or the voters did, in 2006, that was the first time that rights were taken away explicitly under the Constitution. The process is complicated for the Constitution in that we have to pass an amendment. If we were to pass it in the 2017 session, you wait for an intervening General Assembly election, which would be in November of 17 for the members of the House. Then we'd have to pass it again with the exact same words in 2018, and then finally it would go to the voters. So if we don't get this done in 2017, the earliest it would get there would be 2020.
I understand the emotional appeal of not having a law so out of sync with what the law of the land is and how it would affect people, how they feel about themselves, how communities feel about them. But aren't there also all types of laws that are still on the books, restricted covenants against African Americans buying property? I think somebody jokingly noted that fornication, the sex between two individuals, is still illegal in the state of Virginia, although the Supreme Court ruled against that also. It just seems that, is it a battle that worth fighting, given that there are so many laws that are still on the books and across the 50 states that are not enforced because things have changed, laws have changed, courts have ruled? What beyond an emotional, comforting victory is it?
Well,
may I also say some people think, well, a future Supreme Court could reverse the same-sex marriage ruling, and then therefore the state's laws would be back in effect.
Sure, that's something that my more conservative colleagues might argue. It's more than emotional. We want people to know they're welcome in Virginia and not see that in the Constitution. But there are a lot of antiquated laws, and I've worked on a few of them. We repealed the law against cohabitation, by lewd and lascivious cohabitation, mm-hmm. by unmarried individuals. I was able to get that through a few years ago. We had a law that practically forbid the serving of sangria in restaurants, which I took on and got that passed a few years ago. There was an effort to deal with the fornication law that was stalled. You're right, but we need to fix things, whether we can't get them all done at once. I still think we should press ahead among our other legislative business.
The famous case in the 60s, Loving versus Virginia, the interracial marriage, was that a constitution or was that a law in the state? I don't remember. I believe it was our law. I wonder if that's still on the books.
I'm sure it's not because I've looked at the marriage law, but I'll be sure to check it out.
Okay,
Tom,
check that out.
You're making
we'll
a note of it even as
well.
We speak. Tom, put on your headphones because we're going to Tony in Centerville, Virginia. Tony, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Hi, Tony, are you there?
Maybe. He's waiting for me to put my headphones on there. Now he can speak.
No, Tony is no longer there. So I'll go to Dan in Vienna, Virginia. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you for having me. The city of Alexandria, next door to Arlington, has impaneled an ad hoc committee to look into Confederate iconography in within the city, and the advisory group is getting ready to release a report, and part of their recommendation is to rename Jefferson Davis Memorial Highway in Alexandria.
Yep.
Do you still support renaming the highway in Arlington, and do you think the legislature should allow communities to decide what street names they want to have and what the types of streets that the types of people that and perhaps name them after people that they want to honor instead?
Adam Evans.
Sure. The city of Alexandria actually has the right to name its own roadways. Arlington does not. Arlington roads are state roadways. And in Alexandria, we have both Jeff Davis Highway, Route 1, as well as Patrick Street, Henry Street, which then goes into Fairfax, where it's called Mount Vernon Highway. I think that honoring Jeff Davis is not really what I would want to do in the roadways. In fact, when I first moved to Virginia and I saw I was living a few blocks off Jeff Davis Highway, I was surprised, and that's a gateway into Virginia. That said, there are a lot of things named for Confederates, and it's a sensitive issue with my colleagues in Richmond. But I certainly support that. And then on the other hand, a lot of it's subjective. Then we've got the
statue. I'm sorry,
you
support that. You said a lot of things. You support that. You support changing the name.
Changing the name.
But who has the authority to change the Jeff Davis Highway name?
In Alexandria, the city council does. In Arlington, the state does. I know. We've got 135 cities and counties with different charters. Cities have
more
powers.
Maybe there should be a law you can't name a public street after anyone. That would solve the problem.
Well, how would we have Tom Sherwood Boulevard?
We wouldn't have that. That'd be a roadblock for sure.
Republicans in Virginia plan to reintroduce a number of pieces of legislation which Governor McAuliffe vetoed this session. They've packaged them as, quoting here, common sense policy agenda on health care, safety, and business regulation. One of them would prevent parent companies from being classified as co-employers of people who work for independently owned franchises under state labor laws. Another would allow certain school security officers to carry guns. What are the chances for passing that measure now in the General Assembly?
The governor vetoed them last year, and they were sustained in the Senate. They were sustained handily, the vetoes. And in the House, there's 34 Democrats able to sustain the governor's vetoes as well. So these are symbolic exercises. They know there won't be another result, but I guess they feel that there's some PR benefit for them or benefit with their voters.
It's just a politics hour. What the general atmosphere and mood of the country, whether it's the presidential campaign, whether it's the very conservative people who are supporting Trump who feel like their country is slipping away from them, or whether it's the progressive other side that believes no one in the Democratic Party is progressive enough for the issues that face the country. Do you have a general take on the mood? I mean, it just seems we're in quite a chaotic period right now.
I think we are. There's a lot of divisiveness in the country, and part of that stems from everyone being in their own bubble. I try and look outside of my bubble, but my bubble is a liberal district inside the Beltway. I try and understand and wrap my head around why people are supporting Donald Trump when, to me, he's a... I might see him as a bully and someone who calls people names that fourth graders tell my colleagues that they know him as a name caller. And other people apparently see him as shaking things up. I just don't know why, I think the emperor has no clothes, but it's a two-person race, and I guess they feel strong enough about the Supreme Court. I try and see both points of view, but I can't really understand how that could have happened, that he would have been nominated. And that was a pretty, we have a real outsider mood going on in the country, which is part of it.
Earlier, downstate, want to take Senator Eben on a trip downstate?
It would be interesting. Well, I went all the way to Mount Vernon on Wednesday. I mean, I went deep into Virginia.
Well, speaking of downstate, I try and really build up relationships with conservative colleagues. Not that we're going to vote the same way. I know I went 1 year, actually the day of the marriage decision by the Supreme Court, I went and visited with the chairman of the conservative caucus in his law office.
Where was that?
That was in Lexington.
Oh, that's a beautiful little town.
It is. It's a beautiful place.
That's where Virginia Military Institute is, right?
It is, and I've offered two of my conservative colleagues, I suggested that we do reverse town meetings, that I would come to their district, to their town meeting, and just listen if they would come to my district. One of them said, I used to live in Arlington for law school. I know what it's like. The other was not up for it. I actually asked him if he would come to the Michael Moore movie with me. I'd pay for it, and I would go to his district for his town meeting.
Not happening.
Can I, one more point on this. Tim Kaine, before he was announced as the vice presidential nominee, came to Washington earlier this year and spoke before the Hispanic Publishers Association and the African American Publishers Association, which was having its joint meeting for the first time. And in that, I did a story about it. He talked about one of the issues for the most conservative white men, particularly, who are supporting Trump, is that they are fearful and that their country is changing. They see themselves no longer as the dominant racial group in this country, that the browning of America makes them fearful for their future. And he said it not in a sympathetic way, where he obviously didn't agree with him, but he said it in a way to try to understand why people are feeling so strongly about supporting Trump, even when Trump says the most outlandish things, that they don't have anyone else speaking for them.
I think that's a fair analysis. This country, we need to see other points of view. It's not going to be a majority of anything, majority-minority, but different minorities eventually, at least in certain states. And they're feeling what many others have felt, which is that they were not in power, or that their views were not the dominant views, or that they weren't taken as seriously. I think
this is, we're called an inflection point, maybe, in the country.
I think that's accurate. I do think, though, that if we didn't have so many issues with jobs in certain pockets and changing of the employment market, that we might not have the same intensity. But people get threatened by immigration. They get threatened by all kinds of things that I think are not bad.
The news this week has been dominated by the verbal spat between presidential candidate Donald Trump and the Khan family, who lost a son in the Iraq War. His father, Kazir Khan, is from Virginia, and there's been talk of him potentially running for office. Somebody has launched a fundraiser that's already raised more than $10,000.
Yes, an online petition that I don't think Mr. Khan had anything to do with, but I think it shows that
people... Nor
should he.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, we were talking about that before the program. I think that he is really an amazing speaker and has an amazing story and has stood up to a lot of pressure quite well. And he certainly would be someone who could have a future in public service. Although right now, I think his role and his purpose, I assume his self-purpose, is to stand up for what he believes against Donald Trump, and particularly Trump's vilifying and scapegoating of Muslim Americans.
Yeah. And, you know, the Gold Star organization is located right here in the District of Columbia. It was created in 1928 by a mother who had lost a son in war and didn't want others to feel alone, and they would put the star in the window that showed that your son had died fighting for the country. Of course, it's not just sons anymore. But it's extraordinary how that... Did you go to the convention?
I was at the convention.
Were you in the hall for that particular 7.5 minute speech when Mr. Khan spoke?
I was not.
Okay. Well, you missed the best part.
I know.
The entire convention.
And it goes to show that there are lots of speeches at the conventions, and
Speaking of going to the convention, I want to talk with you a little bit more about that later. But first, let's talk with Steve in Bethesda, Maryland, and then we can move on to the convention. Steve, your turn.
Hi there. Thanks. Great discussion of politics. Taking you back a couple minutes. Regarding the Jefferson Davis Highway discussion. So I'm a U.S. history major, but I consider myself a reasonably moderate Democrat. But when I see the extremes of liberalism, it tends to activate the extremes of the opposite as well. So So when you're talking about renaming highways in places because they were connected with the South or, you know, embarrassing history, isn't that extreme to the point that we then need to start reconsidering other things that involved slavery and, kings and queens? Maryland was named after Queen Mary. Queen Anne County, Baltimore is named after Lord Baltimore. Once we start picking these things apart, there's a lot of our history, which I think is worth keeping out there, and is worth keeping, you know, within what we do. But okay. At what point is it enough is enough? So I'll take my answer
off the air. Send it to Eben.
Yeah, that's
sure. I recognize a lot of people see it as a slippery slope. This is something that I would support, not something that I'm initiating. But I think it's worth noting that Jefferson Davis was not a Virginian, was, for a loaded word, a traitor. I would say
he's president of the Confederate States of America. And he's also a U.S. congressman and a secretary of war.
Sure, from Mississippi and other. Yeah. Yes. But I would say also that there are certain things I would never change, like the statue of Appomattox looking south from Old Town that's been there looking towards, with a kind of a forlorn look towards his fallen comrades that's been there for so long, or statues on Monument Avenue in Richmond. I just don't think that has to be the honor that we accord to him. I think that if it was because he's Jefferson Davis, a lot of controversy could arise, but it's up to Alexandria if they want to honor someone else, in my opinion.
Well, it seems to me, I wrote columns about this because, you know, if we want to start cleansing the public statues and buildings and roadways, I mean, somebody suggests we take Richard Russell's name off the Senate building because he had opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And someone else pointed out, well, you know, he also passed legislation to get school lunches for all students. And then we could go to the Washington Monument, where Washington had slaves, and Jefferson Memorial. All these issues, you could take down everything, and we start the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. There are. To me, it seems to me we ought to educate people why that bridge is named and what the troubles of it are. There's a memorial there at that bridge in Selma, but it's not nearly enough to talk about the civil rights. So I just think we should, if we start renaming the country, we'll never finish.
Got to get back to the Democratic National Convention, because you, Adam Eben, were there, not as a delegate this time, and I'd like to bring into the conversation our next guest in this broadcast, who I am assuming attended the Democratic National Convention also, but I could be wrong. Ike Leggett is Montgomery County Executive. He joins us by phone. Ike Leggett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I was at the convention.
You're a former state party chair. Do you get special consideration? Were you a super delegate that was just, you know, rigging the system for the Democrats?
Yes, I was a super delegate for Clinton.
Well, I'll start with you, Senator Eben. Virginia's own Tim Kaine is Hillary Clinton's running mate. What does he bring to the ticket, and what will it mean for winning your key state of Virginia in November's election?
Well, I think he brings a lot in Virginia, but beyond Virginia, he has a sensibility that he was born and raised in the Midwest.
Minnesota, right?
Minnesota is where he was born. I think he grew up in Missouri, if I'm not mistaken. But I think he can relate to in Iowa and Ohio and Pennsylvania and those places a lot to those white men you describe. Now, he may not be Joe Sixpack, but he's more of a Joe Sixpack than Hillary, and more of he talks with people. He's a listener. He has a special appeal to Latino votes. I think that he'll be our first Virginia vice president since John Tyler, if things go okay.
Wow.
I think, Ojo, the most important thing is, I think on day one, he's ready to be president.
Mm-hmm. What leads you to say that?
Because I think that he's eminently qualified. This is a person who served on the city council in Richmond, served as a mayor, served as a governor of a great state, served as a U.S. senator. I think that he has a very good grasp of foreign and military affairs. I think that he knows individually communities very well. And I think he speaks to a broader constituency beyond just Virginia. I think that the most important prospect is that he is a person on day one is capable of being president of the United States. And I think that's the most important characteristic that you find in selecting someone for vice president.
Do you think Mike Pence, the Republican nominee for vice president, is not qualified on day one?
I would not say he's not qualified. I just think that given his position on issues, and I think his temperament along with Trump and acceptance of what I think the top of his ticket brings for the nation, I don't think that he's the best choice for vice president or for president.
The Clinton campaign, Politico reported this week, has withdrawn or decided not to advertise in Virginia. Is Virginia a battleground state or is it not?
Well, it's been a battleground state in the past, and I don't want to take anything for granted. We're giving our full effort, but apparently from that ad decision, we're doing okay. I'm sure we're going to keep that they'll keep looking at it, but we're not going to stop our field efforts at all. And in fact, I think that the way the ticket is going, that Lou Anne Bennett in the 10th district may benefit greatly the Democratic nominee. And just to follow on what county executive had said, Tim is certainly qualified on day one. And I think part of that is because in each office he's held, there's been great difficulties. He's not served as a mayor of a majority black city in an easy time or as a governor during
the Virginia
Tech.
He actually apologized, I believe, didn't he? As mayor, he apologized for the discrimination against African Americans.
He did, and he took some other steps to heal that city. And then as governor, we had tough fiscal times, and we had a tragedy at Virginia Tech, and each office has been tough.
Got to move on. Adam Eben is a Virginia state senator. He's a Democrat. He represents the 30th district, which includes parts of Arlington, Alexandria, and Fairfax County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be continuing our conversation with Montgomery County Ike Leggett in a minute. In the meantime, if you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Watch our live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org, where you can also ask questions or make comments or shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. But Tom, I do have to mention the situation of Nicholas Watson. Those of our listeners who were listening when we had our membership campaign at the end of last year, we'll remember that for years, Tom Sherwood had been saying if somebody would make a one-time contribution of $3,000, then he would get a tattoo. On this last drive, both Councilmember Mary Che, who was in studio, and I joined in that request. And to our surprise, that $3,000 contribution came in, and we went and got those D.C. flag tattoos. That contribution came from Nicholas Watson, then a 23-year-old young man who happened to be listening to the Politics Hour because he listened to it on a regular basis. Since then, we have learned that last month, Nick and his fiance were involved in a tragic accident in France. They were riding motor scooters, and they were really run over. It caused a serious brain injury to Nick Watson that caused him to be in a coma for a while. I talked this morning with his father, Dr. Tim Watson, who says that Nick is showing some signs of recovery. He is responding to verbal commands, but he will take a long time to recover. You can find out a lot more about this if you go to our website, kojoshow.org. But Tom, I'm sure you wanted to say something.
I do. You know, he came to the 8th Street Fatty's Tattoo Parlor with the biggest grin on his face, talked about how he was going to get a tattoo, and he just thought it was such a fun thing to do to both support WAMU, to support you, Kojo, and your show, to participate in public radio, and then to go on a holiday into France, and then on the last day to decide to go on a motorcycle ride with his girlfriend, and then to be hit by what we're being told is a drunk driver. It's a very difficult thing because when I say I didn't know him before this, and now every day now since I've heard about this, when I see my tattoo, I think of him, and there's been a nice response to an effort to raise some money to help pay for the costs that are not covered by insurance or whatever. I think he's at Vanderbilt University Hospital now. And as you said, he's responding with some thumbs up gestures. But it's going to be a very long recovery for him. And so I would appreciate it for anyone who listens to and appreciates this show, that maybe they take a moment to go to WAMU.org and to see what the situation is and at least have him in your thoughts.
It is the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Our guest is Ike Leggett. He's the Montgomery County executive. The Purple Line has run into a roadblock, if you will, with its federal funding because of a lawsuit that led to a court ruling which made the Purple Line temporarily ineligible for federal aid. It's my understanding that the Federal Transit Administration was due to sign over $900 million in federal funding on Monday, but now that has been postponed apparently indefinitely. Mr. Leggetts, what's going on?
Well, to say it mildly, this is a disappointment, but I anticipate that it would be a temporary one. Unfortunately, I was scheduled Monday to participate in a signing ceremony, and that will not occur. But if you look at the decision, I'm a little bit baffled by the ultimate outcome of that decision, but we have to deal with it. The Secretary of Transportation has indicated an appeal to the decision, and so we're going to go forward with the appeal. But it is a disappointment and a setback, and hopefully it's only a temporary setback. Yes.
What's your opinion about the Purple Line? Give us a call, 800-433-8850.
Mr. Leggett, is the $900 million now back in the pot for somebody else to lay claim to it, or is it in the secure location?
That's a good question. I assume that it's still on hold for the utilization as the Purple Line. And I think that these kinds of lawsuits pop up periodically, so I don't think a temporary delay will jeopardize the money per se. But this is something that could drag on for a period of time. And I'm hopeful, either by way of appeal or in some way resolving the issues that the Judge Leon has indicated need to be resolved, can in fact be done in the most expeditious manner. Yeah.
The District Court Judge Richard Leon said that the Maryland Transit Administration has to consider, as I understood from this lawsuit, has to consider the impact on the Purple Line if Metro's ridership is still uncertain and maybe declining, and that could affect the people who ride the Purple Line when it is built, and that could affect the financing for it, and the whole thing could become unraveled. Why is that a serious? Why is that not a serious concern? Metro has terrific problems, and are you basing the success of the Purple Line on Metro's success?
Well, here's what a little bit baffling to me in the decision. He's taken all of the negative things that impact Metro now, today, that obviously would affect ridership, but he's not taking into consideration, I think, the more positive things that Metro is now doing. It is, in fact, resolving some of the more difficult challenges related to safety, which has a direct impact on ridership. And he's looking at the projections today and not looking at them for the future. Given the amount of growth that will occur in the county, the increase in population, the fact that the ridership numbers are based upon a future projection, and not taking into consideration all of the many factors that go into a positive increase of ridership, to me, I find that a little bit baffling. He's simply taking current affairs today, looking at the negative impact today, and not, I think, properly calculating all the positive things that Metro is doing that will, in fact, increase ridership.
Here's something that baffles me. That money, $900 million, was nearly half the $2 billion cost of the project, and redoing ridership calculations could delay things by 6 months. Why does it take six months to redo ridership calculations?
Bureaucracy.
That's part of the bureaucracy, but I think we could do it sooner than that. But to me, I think that the best way is do two things. A, do the calculations that's required, and also appeal. So you're doing two things simultaneously so that you could cut down the amount of time that will be utilized in this process.
If it's not a thorough recalculation, then the people who have brought the suit, I'm sorry, I was looking for the name of the principal person who brought the suit. If you don't do a thorough recalculation, then that will be subject to challenge also.
Yeah, but I agree
also
with Kojo. It shouldn't take 6 months to do a thorough recalculation on calculation that you've already made, that which you are now going back to simply amend based on the factors of the downturn in ridership, based on the safety facts and the challenges Metro is having. It should not take, theoretically, it should not take that long.
And any delay will make it cost more than in.
I was about to say, if there's a delay, what would that mean for the ultimate cost of the project, and what might it mean for the public-private partnership behind it?
Well, I think that the public-private partnership right now is still intact if we're still talking a six-month delay. I think there are some challenges related to the point made of increased cost potentially, because if you look at what has been prepared now, it's based on cost based on an estimate within a certain time frame. Clearly, when you have inflation and everything else involved in these kinds of things, the cost potentially could go up. So we could have the worst of all situations here. We could have a situation whereby we are delayed more than 6 months, We could have a situation whereby we get the numbers in, and then we've simply added nothing else in this process other than increase the cost of the project.
Just very quickly on thumbnail, $900 million from the feds for a $2 billion project. The state, Governor Hogan significantly dropped the state investment to around under $600,000. And that, does that mean that you and Prince George's County are making up the rest?
We are making up some of it. There's some of it that is being made up by increased contribution by Prince George's and Montgomery County, some by the state, and I think some by the estimates. And I think that may be an attempt to even get more from the federal government as well. So you're looking at a project that would go for a considerable period of time, probably 5 or 6 years for ultimate construction. And so I think the numbers are based on all of those factors combined. But there's no way that Montgomery and Prince George's County can make up that delta between the difference between the state, the federal contribution, and what is left therein.
Let me ask you to put on your law professor hat for a minute here, because the plaintiffs in this case are two Chevy Chase residents and the nonprofit group Friends of the Capitol Crescent Trail, and they filed on the basis of environmental grounds. So where does the relationship between the environmental concerns and the ridership calculations come in?
Well, that's a good question, but I think the calculation made based on, they would have to respond to it themselves, because I did not see precisely what they saw. But a calculation would be that part of that is based on the ridership, which increased the cost. If you do not have the costs associated with all of these projects, you can't respond to all the challenges, which means environmental challenges as well. All of those part of associated with cost in this factor. So if you didn't do the cost right, then it's going to affect the entire project, including the environmental factors as well.
So what happens next?
Well, we're in appeal, we will continue to move forward. I'm in consultation with the state now to see whether or not we can move forward on the calculation so that we won't have a big chance of time delay here, because if for some reason you don't lose the appeal and then you wait after the appeal has been exhausted to start the recalculation, then it may mean more than 6 months, because it may take a considerable time just to do the appeal. So we need to do both simultaneously here in a way to reduce the amount of time which this project may be delayed.
And will that in fact happen, that they will be simultaneous?
That's what I'm hoping, and we'll be talking next week. I have a meeting next week with the Secretary of Transportation, and hopefully we'll be able to do both of those things.
Could talk to him about putting some federal money into the operation of Metro while you're at it.
Oh, yeah.
He's very good. He seems to me the Secretary is very good at grousing and pointing out failures. He hasn't pointed anyone towards a bank yet.
That's right. Well, we are looking desperately to come up with a formula.
Let me come with you on that meeting. Where is that meeting?
Deputy Mayor and Assistant County Executive Tom Sherwood.
Well, you may want to come to it, because it's going to be in Ocean City, Tom. So you may want to come.
Too crowded down there. Okay. Can you move it up to Rehoboth?
On to the telephones. If you're willing to discuss international affairs, here is Mike in Bethesda, Maryland. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks a lot, Kojo. County Executive Leggett, in your position as being part of the convention that just culminated in Philadelphia and the Democratic Party's position now against the President's Trans-Pacific Partnership and, to my knowledge, the Transatlantic Investment Partnership, too, Montgomery County doesn't have any incentives like Prince George's County does, where the county itself is entirely internationally eligible for international traders to use on the local level. Does Montgomery County have any interest or any ambition to align itself with Prince George's County's international trade portfolio to add value to the Purple Line or get some primary anchor jobs in the communities, like for biomedical, et cetera? So I'm speaking specifically about Prince George's County's foreign trade zone.
Let the record show that Tom Sherwood and I are puzzled, but go ahead, please.
I'm processing.
Puzzle is an understatement for me, but please go ahead, Mr. County Executive. Oh, I think we lost contact with Isaiah Leggett at that point, so please call us back quickly.
Coach, you answer that question.
No, in the meantime, we still have Mike on the line. Mike, can you explain exactly what you're talking about here?
Each state
has enabling legislation that allows it to engage in international trade independent of what happens from the executive level.
Mm-hmm.
So Maryland itself has a Foreign Trade Zones Act. Prince George's County has taken advantage of getting their own authority to enable international commerce on the local level. It has to happen through the consent of the school board, et cetera, or Sharon Baker. But Montgomery County has, for some reason, been excluded from international trade. I don't know if it's intentional or just through bureaucratic neglect or oversight, but because the party itself, the Democratic Party itself, has taken a position against TPP nationally, is there any intent on the local level to take advantage of still what's inevitable, international trade will happen?
What is Prince George's County doing? Is it small, toe-in-the-water type stuff, or is it really involved somehow?
Well, I mean, they're not building airplanes. There have been Irish investors, French investors, English investors, West African investors looking at using the benefits. I'm not sure why Prince George's County doesn't enable them to let them use it. But we're almost at $1 trillion of U.S. commerce flowing through these special types of zones. But they've got the authority. They've got the real estate designated. They've got vacant properties. They've got operators in the community. They've had interested parties, but no one of record is actually of use right now.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. Once we get the county executive back, and he is now back on the line, Ike Leggett.
I've never seen someone duck a question so well.
No, I wanted to ask a question. I think that we have a very strong international component of our challenges in Montgomery County. For example, we reach out desperately to many places all around the world, from Israel to India, China, to South Korea. We have sister city relationship and an agreement with some of the major components around the world that will allow us to do much of what you've just suggested. We certainly will look at what Prince George's County is doing so that we can take advantage of every opportunity that may be out there for our community.
Okay, thank you very much for your call.
What happened to the quality of your phone connection there? It sounds like you're under the ocean.
Yeah, I think that things are happening. I'm at home today, so it's a very difficult place in terms of connectivity out here.
Go ahead, Tom. Oh,
can we talk about the convention again?
Sure.
Sure.
What did you do? No. Were you in the convention center when Mr. Khan and his wife were on the stage and he spoke?
Yes, I was there. Yes.
I was at home on the sofa. I went to the Republican convention in Cleveland, but I watched the Democratic convention from the comfort of my sofa. And I found his remarks, whether you politically would agree with him or whatever, his talk was riveting. And I'm just wondering, what was it like in the hall itself?
Well, it was very interesting because, you know, you have a lot of big people with booming voices and people who have the ability to command the audience because of just the sound of their voices sometimes. But here's a person who is able to talk intellectually, sound, read, and above everything else, relating to people. And it had a very profound impact, I think.
You need
the other voices that you heard throughout the convention did not.
Okay.
And there was diversion of speakers and people listening in different directions, and it had a very common effect to speak a little lower, a little bit plainer in many ways, but intellectually sound and with some experience and understanding of what it takes in order to fill this job. I found it very refreshing, to be honest.
When you describe somebody who speaks in low tones and still has an effect, you seem to be talking about yourself also. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Good luck with the Purple Line.
Montgomery County Executive. We have a few callers who wanted to weigh in on an issue we discussed earlier. Here is Elizabeth in Washington. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. So going back to the conflict of interest with Vince Orange, and the show a couple days ago, when he mentioned that David Catania and I forget what other council member had lobbied on behalf of their private employers, and which received somewhere in the
And he said, region. Mary Che gets 4 tickets to every Washington Capitals
right.
game.
Why
all
right.
get tickets.
If Vincent Orange was getting 4 tickets for every game, they'd hang me. But go ahead, please.
Right, and then something like one of the council members, I think it was Catania, who successfully lobbied for $50 million to, you know, his private employer's benefit. Anyway, I just think that it's high time, you know, in the district where we have had so many conflict of interest and worse scandals with the council, that taxpayers really demand that council members be full-time and be prohibitive from having outside
Mr. Orange himself had introduced legislation to that effect some time ago.
Let's be clear here. Right. We just said, I don't recall with Catania. I know he worked for MC Dean, which has a lot of various city contracts. But I'm not aware of any time that he's ever was accused of lobbying on behalf of MC Dean. Let's be clear about that, because I don't want him to call me up. Are you aware of, in fact, I don't think that's an issue at all.
No, as far as I know, that's
just to be clear. But he did work for MC Dean, which had city contracts, and he says, and no one ever, to my knowledge, suggested he mixed those up. Same with Jack Evans, who worked for a law firm, didn't mix those up. And Mary Chase, a law professor, I think, with George Washington University. That's separate from...
That's all the time we have, and thank you very much for your call, because, Tom, we have got some things to do, and the thing we're going to do now requires a bit of a fanfare.
May you build a ladder to the stars, and climb on every road, may you stay.
Well, here's the deal. He doesn't like Happy Birthday, so we decided to play another song because we're really celebrating Tom Sherwood's birthday. Here is for you. That's your card. Here is your whiskey.
Oh, good.
Which we know
sounds
that
like
you
a Jack Daniels
imbibe.
Well, this is like a gin bottle.
I don't know. Oh, these are cups.
I'm getting presents.
These are cups for us to drink all of the whiskey you have
achieved. Watch it streaming now.
You've achieved a very significant milestone here. So
can you say, I'm actually happy to be 70 years old.
It's all gravy from here on, Pat.
And it's a hair a lot. Well, you don't look 70. I feel sorry for people who look 70. Well, I guess, there we go. but anyway, thank you. My son insisted on having a little gathering for me. He took me out to dinner. He picked up the check, and I'd like to say Red Hen, a delicious restaurant. But I've enjoyed this birthday, but I'm looking forward to being 71.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening online. In fact, head on over to Facebook.com/Kojo Show right now, because in a few minutes we'll be giving everyone a behind-the-scenes peek of this broadcast and chance to ask questions of me, Tom Sherwood, and our producers. It's part of the real-time newsroom initiative that's taking place while the National Association of Black Journalists and National Association of Hispanic Journalists are in town holding a joint conference. Join us, then be sure to enjoy your weekend, rest up, and meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll talk with outgoing D.C. Schools Chancellor Kaya Henderson. She'll talk about her 5 years at the helm. Plus, win or lose in November, Donald Trump will have a property on Pennsylvania Avenue. We'll talk about why the Trump Hotel, set to open soon, is at the center of protests about public space and free speech. It's all Monday at noon. Thank you all for listening. Until then, I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Kayla Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.